As educators, it's often our learners who struggle the most that keep us up at night. We believe they can thrive in math, but we aren't always sure how best to support them. I had the pleasure of talking to Julie Dixon, who is a professor at the University of Central Florida and co-author of the Making Sense of Teaching Mathematics series. Her work with students and teachers has led to numerous publications, including textbooks, articles, and her new Fact Tactics Fluency program. In this interview, Julie talks about everything from the types of lessons we should be focusing on when working with learners who struggle to ideas for developing fact fluency, even when it feels like there just isn't enough instructional time. I think you're gonna love this conversation with Julie. So let's get started with the interview. Thank you so much for joining me today. You have no idea what an honor it is to have you on the show.
I'm honored to be here. I'm really excited that you invited me to join.
We are going to be talking a lot about our students who struggle in learning math and also fact fluency, which is a hot topic because I'm sure you know we have so many students sitting in classrooms who aren't fluent in their facts, and teachers aren't quite sure what to do with that. I would love to know what really sparked your passion for just learning about and working with and supporting teachers who are working with students who struggle learning math.
So the response to that's really personal, and I'm happy to share it with you. My daughter, who is now 26, when she was 10, got really sick, and she had pneumonia. It triggered this glitch in her central nervous system, and by the time she turned 12, she needed brain surgery as a last-ditch effort to save her life. During brain surgery, she had a massive stroke. The stroke destroyed the part of her brain that was killing her, but it left her in this space where she had to relearn everything. So in the middle of sixth grade, I have a daughter who has significant struggles in learning. And as a teacher, I used everything I'd ever been taught to reteach her, as did her teachers and her support and her community. But I really feel like that moment in time for me, that time when I needed to reteach everything, changed all of my beliefs about education, as well as my approach to teaching mathematics. And so my support for learners who struggle comes from a personal space of reteaching my daughter, who became a learner with significant struggles. So I needed to figure out what were we doing wrong, where students who struggle weren't catching up. You know, why don't we close this achievement gap, this performance gap, with all the energy we're putting into supporting our learners who struggle? And I came to feel that, and was supported to understand, that we can't teach everything. We can't teach everything with understanding to our students who struggle, or else we're just doing the same thing we did the first time, teaching too much too quickly. Yeah. And so since then, it's been 14 years, I've been examining and making sense of supporting learners who struggle to be successful in mathematics. And now my daughter works in public schools with young learners, also supporting students who struggle.
Wow. I just love that. And thank you so much for sharing just that personal story. I can't even imagine what that was like, but to hear how that impacted just your approach to math education and what you believe about students who learn math, that's just such a beautiful story. You mentioned in the story, you said something about your entire perspective or just your entire view of how we teach students math changed. What was I know you talked about teaching students too much content at one time. Was there anything else that changed for you in that season with how you viewed teaching math?
Yeah, so much. But working harder doesn't mean we're going to be successful. We have to work strategically as teachers, and we have to focus on helping students to make sense of the mathematics. See, our students who struggle, often their memory is less accessible. So if we just focus on memorization, and students are hungry, are stressed, are anxious, then they may not be able to retrieve what we've just taught them to remember.
Yeah.
But if we use lots of different links in how we teach, so that we teach for understanding, but we also include practice, we reach for proficiency, but fall back on doing what makes sense in mathematics for students, for young learners, then they've got all of these different links in their brains to get to the math when they can't remember, because we're going to need to count on them not remembering.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest shift.
You know, and it's interesting because, you know, in my work with teachers, I've learned that I think there's a misconception around what students who struggle with math are capable of. A lot of times the approach is, okay, this student's struggling, they have gaps in their understanding, and we just need to give them more practice. We just need to, you know, give them a time in small groups, and we just need to continue to practice the basics so that they can eventually, you know, catch up. And I think sometimes we maybe forget that these students are capable of understanding. And so I would love to hear kind of like, what do you tell teachers who maybe aren't aware of like their doubts of the fact that their struggling learners still have the ability to truly understand math?
It's sometimes from a place where teachers are really trying to protect their students from feeling the disappointment of not understanding. And I try to shift the perspective to say, if we don't allow them to try, then we're not giving them the opportunity to reach their full potential. Yeah. So it's part of why I continue to work in classrooms and work with students who struggle, so that I can demonstrate, model what I mean. If we give students tasks that push them to do the sense making, and then provide the scaffolding just in time when students demonstrate that their struggle is no longer productive, we help them to develop perseverance. It's that perseverance that gives them the capacity to reach their goals and the goals we have for them. So what often happens, and you alluded to this, is that teachers, to protect their students, will provide scaffolding just in case students need it so that things stay comfortable. But when things stay comfortable, we end up complacent. What we need is just the right amount of discomfort that we learn to work through to get at that deep understanding. So when I model for teachers, I teach their students so that they can see their students reaching this potential they didn't even realize they had.
Yeah.
Not because I don't believe in the students, but because they're trying to protect them. But they're protecting them from their own success, I think.
I love what you just said there. You know, a couple of things. One, you kind of reframed that in that it's not that a teacher doesn't necessarily believe in their students. It's that they are trying to protect them. So I love that. Thank you for sharing that. But actually, the other thing that you said led right into another question that I had for you. One article that you have written that I have shared over and over and over is the article that you wrote about just-in-time versus just-in-case scaffolding. Would you share with our teachers just what exactly that is and what the difference is? You kind of touched on it, but I would love to just be, you know, just really clarify, what are the difference between these two approaches to scaffolding?
Sure. So when we think about differentiation, we often think about providing scaffolding. Right. So I'm going to differentiate for my learners by providing scaffolding I think they might need. When we do that, we're lowering the bar and lowering our expectations for what students can accomplish by providing scaffolding just in case they might need it. In contrast, and what I suggest to replace that with is scaffolding just in time. So we don't want students to have unproductive struggle in their learning, but we do want them to have struggle to develop this perseverance. When we provide scaffolding just in time, when students demonstrate the need, then we're giving students just the amount of support necessary for them to keep moving forward. So we still scaffold, but we wait for students to demonstrate that they need the scaffolding as opposed to assuming they're going to need the scaffolding before the lesson even begins.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a really important equity issue, because we all have our own biases. We all have our own, you know, one of the things that I really struggled with as a teacher is getting a bunch of documents about our students and saying, okay, this student is at a second grade level. And you read that and it does change your mindset. You say, okay, I know that this person's going to need a lot of support. And while I think having all the information you can have is so helpful, I think with that information, it can be so easy to jump into that just in case scaffolding. We in our mindset know, okay, you know, we've been told this student struggles in math, they've never passed their end of grade test. And so it's like, okay, we're going to provide them a lot of support instead of really letting the child work and us kind of follow their lead in the sense and say, okay, now they're stuck. What can I do to support them to move them on to, you know, that next piece of learning? Is that kind of what you mean when you talk about that just in case versus just in time scaffolding?
Absolutely. And it's hard, right? We should acknowledge that it's tough to do because it requires us to think on our feet, think while teaching. And it's hard to think while teaching, especially for new teachers when so little is automatic. And so instead, we set things up in advance and take away the opportunity for students to learn as much as they could. So with your equity focus, and I love that, and it's so important, here's the spin that I would give to looking at the information about students in advance. Look at the information about students in advance for what accommodations they might need, because accommodations should be provided just in case students need them. Let the student behaviors in the classroom, the student's responses to tasks, tell you about the scaffolding, and then provide that just in time.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for pointing that out. I think that's really good information and a really helpful way for us to get that information and use it in a productive way. But that doesn't, like cap students from having that time of thinking and the productive struggle, you know, because we're trying to protect them. So you mentioned that this like thinking on our feet and the just in time scaffolding can be really hard for new teachers. And especially I think teachers who maybe don't feel as confident in the math themselves. You know, maybe they taught high school and they're coming down, or maybe they taught kindergarten and they're moving to fifth grade. How do you support teachers who already don't necessarily feel confident in the math themselves to be able, I guess, to know how to provide that just in time scaffolding?
It's really tricky because teachers are working harder than they've ever worked ever. And to ask teachers to do more is pretty unfair right now. So my response, my goal is to be strategic in that response. By that, I mean that we can't ask teachers to plan deeply for every lesson every day. There's not time. So when we do, the teachers who are trying to do their best all the time burn out because it's just too exhausting. So we want to provide different feedback and more strategic feedback. What I encourage is to take a broad look at a unit to come. And I'm only talking about mathematics. That's where my expertise is completely and only. But so we're looking at this unit to come in mathematics. Often, if you're using a published curriculum, there's a teacher's guide that goes with it. That teacher's guide should help us to understand the most important math of the unit. Like, what are the most important lessons? A teacher may know this already, but you're talking about a teacher who's a little uncomfortable with the math they're teaching. So if they're uncomfortable with the math they're teaching, they might look to that for some guidance. Then when they identify the most important topics of that unit, say a unit's 2 to 3 weeks of instruction, spend your time planning the lessons of those most important topics of the unit so that you're planning a reasonable amount. You're not planning deeply for every lesson every day, but that planning before the unit begins will change how you address every other lesson in the whole unit, so that when you're teaching, you'll understand the math more deeply, you'll know what to do with students' responses.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that, you know, what you just said really gives permission to teachers. The bar to teach every lesson at just an incredible level of depth and detail, that bar is just unrealistic. And so I love that you're giving teachers permission to say, okay, let me focus on these most important lessons. And these are the ones that we're just really going to go into detail in the planning and the depth. So I think that's really important. And it becomes a realistic goal for sure.
And those lessons are typically the ones that focus on developing the conceptual understanding. How do you choose the most important lessons of the unit? Often they're the lessons that focus on developing conceptual understanding. That's the part our learners who struggle should focus on at the start, that conceptual understanding, because with the memory, if we just linger on the procedural lessons, if they forget how to do that procedure, they're stuck. If we linger and go deeply on the lessons based on concepts, we're giving students the tools to do the sense making. So that's where I would suggest teachers linger.
Yeah, so lingering on those lessons that develop conceptual understanding. Something else that's in one of your books, you talk about like the layers of facilitation. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times I think there is this mindset that our students who struggle, they need to be told exactly what to do. And they need to, you know, we start with like, let me do this. Let me show you how to do it. And then we can do it together. And then you do it on your own. And I would love to hear kind of your thoughts on how that way of teaching impacts students who struggle learning math or maybe like a different approach, which I know you've talked about with the layers of facilitation.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So if our goal is for students to always be able to copy us all the time and we'll always be there to model first, then that explicit direct instruction of I'm going to do it first, we're going to practice it together, and then you're going to do it on your own would be a great one to use all the time. But that's not our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is to develop problem solvers. And so if our goal is for students to make sense of problems, we can't make sense of those problems for them first. It undermines our very objectives. So if our objectives are for students to do the sense making, let's set the stage for students to make sense of problems. So you're going to make sense of this problem, and then we're going to work on it together in collaborative groups so that we're building on this idea that learning is social. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to bring you back in to make sure you take from that experience the key points I needed you to take. Right? So it really doesn't follow this gradual release of responsibility that so many people use. Right? We're layering the facilitation so that we're working on things together. You're going to have a little more automaticity, but I'm still going to support you. Eventually, you should be able to do it on your own. Now, that explicit direct instruction, there is a place for it. When we're teaching a procedure like long division, I'm not expecting students to make sense of long division on their own. When I've already addressed a concept and now I want to connect that to a more efficient procedure, then I will model it. We will practice it together, and then I'll want you to have some independent practice with it as well.
Yeah.
So it's almost that happens at the end of a unit, as opposed to at the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where sometimes there's this, maybe like some misunderstanding around when that explicit instruction comes in, because there is value, especially when we're talking about a more procedural topic or concept. And of course, we want to make sure that that, you know, procedural fluency we know comes from that conceptual understanding. So we want to have that opportunity for them to work and understand first. But I can't think of a single time where I've told students how to understand something in math. I feel like there has to be that time of struggle, of exploring, of collaboration. And from there, I feel like it's kind of my job to do the consolidating or the synthesizing of what they just learned and help them make those explicit connections between, you know, what they're doing and maybe the procedure that it is that they will eventually learn.
Yeah, I like that. And I like that you're talking about doing the synthesizing as well. So it's connected though. You know, we often have this requirement. So many schools have this requirement that teachers post the lesson objective at the start of the lesson, learning target, lesson objective, whatever it's called in the particular school. And when we do that, we're almost already beginning with gradual release. Because when we say, this is what I want you to learn, then we're already telling you what to think about. As opposed to, here's a task, let my questioning bring you to my learning goal. And then in the end, as I synthesize, we can discuss the learning goal for the day.
I love that you brought up the learning goal because another series of articles that I share from you constantly is the, I think the six spheres of administrators' influence. I probably said that wrong. I think you wrote it several years ago. Mm-hmm. And one thing that, you know, the teachers that I work with that they talk a lot about is I feel like I'm learning all of this and I'm hearing what's best for our students who struggle. But I, either from an administrator's perspective or a district perspective, I'm required to do things in a certain way. Now, I have no judgment on administrators. I'm married to an elementary school principal, so I love my administrators. And I know that they can't be experts in every single subject. That's why we have a, they have leadership teams. But what would you tell those teachers who they're like, okay, I'm being told that I've got to follow this. I do, we do, you do, or I've got to, you know, start with the learning goal. Is there a way for them to kind of, I guess, meet the needs of their students while also staying within the expectations of their school?
There is in almost every case. So first, what I found is when I share with administrators the purpose for why I'm suggesting some changes, in every instance, they've agreed and said, oh, that makes sense. Okay, thank you. I'm going to move forward with this. But sometimes we don't have the confidence to do that. We're a new teacher or new to a school, whatever reason, and we're not confident in suggesting this change, there's little tweaks we can do that make things still work. So for example, with posting the lesson objective, if that's something that has to happen, then zoom out on the objective for conceptually based lessons. So instead of saying, if you're looking at comparing fractions by looking at the numerator, you could say, we're going to use strategies to compare fractions. And then by the end, well, what did we use to make sense of these comparing fractions? Students should be able to say, oh, we looked at the number of pieces we had or the numerator and made sense of it, rather than from the start giving it away. So you're still posting a lesson objective, but you're not giving away the aha of the lesson. With the gradual release, I would encourage teachers to use it for the procedural lessons so that they maybe don't have to use it for the lessons that are focused in concepts, or use it for a part of the lesson that still gives space for teachers to have students focus on problem solving. That one's tricky.
Yeah, it is. It is tricky, and it's hard. It's really hard to, you know, take in what you're learning and trying these new things and not feel like you were necessarily like following the rules or the expectations mm-hmm. Of your school. So I really appreciate you giving kind of some easier ways that we can implement this in classrooms where, you know, the expectations kind of push up against what we're hearing is best practice in the classroom. All right. So one other thing that you, you just came out with a new book. Is it Fact-tastics Fluency Program? Did I say that right?
I have it here. It is the Fact-tactics Fluency Program.
Fact-tactics.
Very excited. Yes.
Yes. I was so excited when I saw the book come out because this is something that in our community, we've got a upper elementary math teacher community over on Facebook. And I hear constantly, especially at the beginning of the year, it's like, what do I do with my students who don't know their multiplication facts? And so I definitely think this book hits a need. And I love your approach that you have in the book to building students' fluency with their multiplication facts. And so I'd love to hear from you. Why is having more of a like strategy-based or flexible approach so much more effective than simply getting students to memorize their multiplication facts?
Thanks for asking that. And thanks for talking about this book. I'm really excited about it. So it's still going back to the, if we just focus on memorization, we're giving students one pathway to get to their facts, right? Same with our learners who struggle, but really it's with any learner who, when they're developing any stress or anxiety, they're less likely to get to the fact. But there's more to that. We're going to need to continue to find strategic ways to get better returns on investment and the time we spend with our students learning mathematics. One of those areas is in fact fluency. So we spend quite a bit of time developing fact fluency. And the way we've often done it, we only end up with knowing basic facts. But what we could be doing is to develop multiplicative reasoning. We could help students to make sense of the properties of operations. We can help them to make sense of problem solving, all of these different ways of thinking mathematically while we're developing fact fluency. And that's what fact tactics does.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, we see this. I personally focus on upper elementary, so fourth and fifth grade. And, you know, even getting into multiplying multi-digit whole numbers in fourth grade, you know, the when we're breaking things down in an area model and finding partial products, it's like this is a beautiful continuation to some strategies that they use in third grade to make sense of their facts. Like when we're talking about six groups of four, well, that's five groups of four plus another group of four. Well, that decomposing the numbers in that way, it's exactly what they're doing in fourth grade, just with much bigger numbers. And so I love this. Do you call it like a strategy-based approach, or how do you describe your approach to fact fluency?
Yeah, it's a strategy-based approach based in multiplicative reasoning. But you talked about how in fourth and fifth grade, we can fold back to this fact-focused multiplication in third grade, but you can also look forward to the work that will prepare students for algebra in middle school, multiplying binomials. What you're doing with the area model and partial products can be connected in both directions.
Yeah, absolutely. The number of times where I will talk about the area model and I'll have a teacher in middle school or high school say, I'm so glad you're teaching this in elementary, because it makes their jobs easier as teachers later on. So I love that. For our teachers who are fourth and fifth grade teachers who are the majority of teachers who are likely watching this, one of the biggest things that I hear from them is they feel so much pressure with pacing to constantly be teaching grade level concepts and to stay on pace and all of that, that they don't feel like they have the freedom or the time to kind of like take a step back and really build fluency in this way. And so I'd love to hear kind of like what your thoughts are on that. Maybe like your recommendations as far as, is it something they do for 10 minutes every day? Is it something that they must do before they can move into grade level concepts? Yeah, just any thoughts you have to share about that, I know would be so helpful to our community.
So, and it's part of the reason I built the program. We say we don't have time to focus on our facts, but we're spending so much time focusing on our facts that we're not sort of counting. So my suggestion is this, it's a 20-week program. It takes 10 minutes the first day of the week and maybe 5 minutes a day the rest of the week. It is a game changer because you're developing multiplicative reasoning as you're learning your facts. So I know teachers need more time and we haven't found a way to find it, but we're spending that time. I would do my best to try to carve out that bit of time we're talking about, because it's teaching students to talk mathematically. It's helping them to reason. They're practicing their basic facts. And at the same time, it's not increasing anxiety.
Yeah.
So that we'll develop the facts over time. In the perfect world, in fourth and fifth grade, students would have fluency with their basic facts before the start of the year. But this isn't a perfect world. We have what we're given. This, I think, allows students to keep learning, moving on, while we continue to build in their fact fluency over time.
Yeah, I love that you said, we don't have time to focus on facts, but we are focusing on facts. I mean, because that's the reality. There's so much struggle when students aren't fluent with their multiplication facts. So there's something else that you said, you know, you talked about the routine of getting students to just really talk about math and reason. And one of the things, I believe I saw this in the book, is there a portion like throughout the week where they do connect ahead? Like I thought I saw that there were times in the book that it wasn't just like facts 0 through 12, but that you took that strategy and applied it to bigger numbers. Is that correct?
I did. I'm glad you noticed that. So we so often focus on our learners who struggle, that we sometimes neglect our learners who aren't struggling. And then it's difficult for them to demonstrate adequate yearly progress because they're already meeting expectations, right? So this 20-week program has 20 extension tasks. If a student already knows 4 times 6 without having to think about it, what about 4 times 36? How could they find 4 times 36 without using a standard algorithm, without using, and even partial products is a standard algorithm if we use it procedurally. Mm-hmm. So by encouraging students to come up with these strategies to multiply these extended facts, I guess, or they're beyond facts, basic facts, they're still applying the properties of operations that they're going to need later. Too often in fourth and fifth grade, especially in fifth grade, we'll teach the distributor property of multiplication over addition, but we won't teach it with purpose. Right. By using these tasks in the Fact Tactics Fluency program, they're seeing the value, the benefit of using properties of operations to get to answers they wouldn't have known without them.
In working with our students who come in and they already know the facts, one thing that I love about the opportunity for them to extend it by figuring out like 4 times 36 is you really get an idea of which students just have a fact memorized versus which student truly has a strategy that they could use and apply to that 4 times 36. So I love how you stretch their thinking in that way. And I think that actually gives the teacher more information about what that student's thinking and where they're at.
Absolutely. And what you're getting at is whether or not the student's using multiplicative reasoning. Mm-hmm. Students can memorize all of their basic facts and never use multiplicative reasoning. Multiplicative reasoning allows us to get to facts or get to problems by using other multiplication problems we know. So if students know 4 times 3 is 12, are they using that to know 4 times 30? If they know 4 times 40, are they using that to get 4 times 36? That's where that multiplicative reasoning comes into play. Students who just memorize their basic facts don't use typically multiplicative reasoning to get there. And that's a missed opportunity.
Yeah. And this is when I know that time is such a huge issue. There's a lot that teachers are expected to teach in a single year and at a certain level of depth. But it's one of those things that's like, I think that putting more work on the front end kind of saves you time later, because especially when we have those students who come in, they're in fifth grade, they still don't know their multiplication facts. And it's like, I don't have time to teach the strategies, like they just need to memorize it. But even what you just said about if they have these strategies with these basic facts, they can apply that to larger numbers. And I really truly believe that it makes our grade level content easier when they are already thinking about math in this way. Is that kind of what you've seen in the classrooms that you've worked in?
Absolutely. That is exactly what I've seen. And I started developing this idea and using it in schools. What we saw was so exciting that I ended up writing it as a program and as a book.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, from the teacher's perspective, it takes a lot of trust that putting the time in up front, building their understanding, giving them these strategies, that it will pay off. Because it does in the moment feel like extra work, or like you kind of have to slow down to speed up, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so it does take a certain level of trust. And so I love that you've kind of like laid it all out and you've done this in schools, you've tested it with students and teachers. And so they just have to trust the program. And it's interesting for me, I learned my multiplication facts right alongside my students. Like, I do not believe I was truly fluent with my multiplication facts until I became a teacher. And so another thing that I love about any type of education around teaching multiplication in this way is I think a lot of teachers will discover they can learn new strategies for multiplication facts as well, even just going through and seeing this program and being like, oh, I never thought of it that way. So it's really, I kind of, as I was going through the book, I was like, this is kind of teacher education as well. It's not just for students.
And that's another big part of my passion. I love supporting teachers with their math knowledge for teaching. So writing a book like this was so much fun for me because I wanted to keep that. And I'm really glad that you noticed.
That is very much like our mission as well, is just building teachers' knowledge and confidence. It's not fun to teach a subject that you aren't confident in yourself. So if you're going in and you're questioning your abilities every day, I think that that causes a lack of fulfillment. And so I know for me in my own journey, it has been so exciting to build my understanding of the math I'm teaching. It just makes me that much more passionate, you know, to share that with students and then now share that with teachers. So another series of books that you have, you're busy with writing articles and books and being in classrooms and working with teachers, but you have that Making Sense of Mathematics series, which is just a fantastic series for any teacher, I think, who is brand new to teaching math or is just now exploring what it looks like to teach math for understanding. I love your work in those books.
Thank you. And what I'm most excited about with those books are the classroom videos that we created, right? All too often we say, do this, learn this, but we don't create a shared image of what it looks like during instruction. And so through those books, we went into schools, taught students, and collected classroom video of those experiences to share with teachers as QR codes in the books.
So one of the things that I noticed in the book, and one of the questions that I get a lot anytime I talk about fact fluency with teachers is, how do I assess students? Because we know that time tests aren't a full picture of what students understand. It's really just, can they get it right and can they do it quickly? It's not giving us any information into what their brain was doing, what their thinking was like as they were, you know, figuring out the answer for that fact. And so I love how you approach assessing students' fluency with multiplication facts in the book. Can you share a little bit about kind of like what your system is for assessing those?
Sure. Thanks. And I mean, time tests are, not only are they difficult for what they provide for us, but they're difficult for what they do to students because they often cause anxiety for all levels of learners. And that is never a good thing. So how do we get this idea of what students know and what they have yet to learn in a reasonable amount of time? So I developed these mini assessments. They're 5 questions every week. And they cycle back to facts that students have explored in earlier weeks, as well as facts that students will use to get to facts in future weeks. So I ask on these assessments, did you just know it? Well, what's the product? Then did you just know it? And if you didn't, what fact did you use to get there? What fact tactic strategy did you use to get to the fact when you didn't know it? So 5 questions, it doesn't take that long, and the teacher has a sense of where students are in this learning trajectory. Coming up with those mini assessments took about 10,000 hours, but it was helpful in developing just a reasonable way of seeing where students are.
Yeah. I love that additional column that you have there of like, did you just know it or did you use a strategy? And I think I love it for 2 reasons. One, that gives some really great information to the teacher, but then also I think that it kind of normalizes that using strategies is perfectly okay. Like, we want to know what strategy you've used. So I love that.
Thank you. And using strategies isn't bad as long as it's efficient. Mm-hmm. I have a daughter who's getting a PhD at Harvard in neuroscience. You ask her how she thinks of 6 times 7. She thinks 2 times 7 and triple.
Wow.
Yet she's this high achieving student who uses a strategy to get to her basic facts.
I love that. And I love that you have a daughter who's in neuroscience. Like, that has to be so helpful for your work in math education.
It is helpful in showing me all the things I have yet to learn.
Absolutely. And that leads us to such a great question. You know, you have been just like so instrumental in my journey as an educator. I have absolutely just loved reading your work. And like I said, it's such an honor to even have you here today. But you know, one of our core values is here at Mix and Math is growth and just constantly pursuing learning, being willing to change our beliefs, just always making sure that we are continuing to grow and learn and evolve. And so while you have been like so instrumental in my own growth journey as an educator, I would love to hear if there's anybody, whether it's like a book or a conference or just a researcher or a math educator that's just been really impactful for you as you've grown in your beliefs in math education.
So there's been so many influencers for me, and some of them go back in time. I was a high school math educator. I was preparing secondary teachers to teach math. And then I read this book by Liping Ma. Liping Ma is Knowing and Teaching Elementary School Mathematics. And I thought, I'm focusing on the wrong thing. It doesn't matter what we're doing in high school if we aren't appropriately preparing students in elementary school, which means if we're not focusing in elementary school teachers. And so I shifted my complete focus because of reading that book. And then I had been an elementary school teacher prior, but I changed my focus. I'm a K-12 educator, but my focus really is on K-8 and in elementary, especially because what we do in elementary matters for students' whole lives. It's where we, I think, have the opportunity to make the most difference. And then Thomas Carpenter, he's since passed, but his work with cognitively guided instruction framed how I felt about students coming to understand mathematics. And those who built on that work have been profoundly impactful in my thinking about mathematics teaching and learning.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm a huge fan of CGI. My master's is math education, and we did a lot of work with cognitively guided instruction. And so I love that that was, you know, their work influenced your work. And I think that is such a good like reminder for all of us that it's okay to change paths and it's okay to learn something and realize, I can't even tell you how many times I've learned something and I'm like, I've been doing it wrong, or this wasn't the best. Like, goodness, I think about my first group of students that I ever taught. I'm like, I hope I didn't damage you. I want to go back and do it all over again because I know so much more now. But that is like the beauty of being in this career is just continuous growth. So I love that your work is inspired and you've learned from, you know, others who have done work before you. So I just love asking people that question because especially when it's somebody that I've learned so much from. So thank you so, so much for joining me today. This was so incredibly helpful. I will, of course, list all of your, like where they can find you and all of your books and articles and all of that. Well, I don't think I could list all of the articles because there are so many, but I'll list all of your books. But if our teachers want to connect with you, what is the like number one place that they can get in touch with you?
So at this point, I would say they could email me at juliedixonmath@gmail.com or connect with me on what used to be called Twitter.
Do people call it X now?
I don't know. It seems so variable to me.
Yeah. I think my husband said X the other day and I was like, what is that? He's like, well, that's the new Twitter.
Yeah. So I guess that's where they can contact me.
Okay, perfect. Well, we'll get it all listed.
Awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I look forward to talking math with you again soon.